All right. Well, thanks for coming. Anything from you this morning? Anything that you want to? Well, I read it last week. I told you that last week already because I had to read it before I did anything else because, you know, I know what Mike's doing a little bit, and I kind of know where he ended up. And I read his book, and then I wrote, spent a couple of days this week writing a paper about his book. So I do that before I forget what it's in the book. So when if you get done reading the book, I'll give you my paper. So not before. And if you don't want paper, that's fine too. In Mike's book, he does say that there are some issues that are not totally settled. And I said, well, those issues I have an idea about. So that's why I wrote my paper. So there's still confusion about the amount of change that there is at the second advent and the amount of change that happens at the, quote, well, they call going to the eternal state. I don't like that word because it's not a biblical word, because the eternal kingdom is always the eternal kingdom. So you get the idea that the kingdom is, it's the millennial kingdom. Remember, I talked about this. It's the millennial kingdom. Then after 1,000 years, you have something else. I said, no, it's the kingdom. The millennial kingdom is a 1,000-year aspect of the eternal kingdom. So I think he's a little confused about that. And not confused, because he does, yes, he does go back and forth a little bit, because he talks about all the changes that occur for the kingdom, and then he talks about changes that occur after the kingdom. I said, well, it'd be just easier to make them all happen for the kingdom, and it really fixes all the problems. I mean, not all the problems, but the problems that really generally give us trouble. So when you get done reading the book, I'll give you my paper, but not before. Okay, well, our subject today is Isaiah 54, and we're looking for these little eschatological evidences in Isaiah. We have another one today, and I want to say this. I put up here Jerusalem, the city of God. That's true. I mean, that is really true, that Jerusalem is God's city. And it is the place where he will set up. This is God the Father and God the Son. Revelation says they're both there on earth in the New Jerusalem, reigning, we say the universe, reigning from there. So this place where God is going to reign from is in a city. We talked about that. We're social beings. We're not out in the acreage. So God's a social being. He made us after all. And there are three people in the Trinity, three persons in the Trinity after all. So we're built to be social. We interact with each other. And if you don't do that, you're odd. We call you odd hermits or whatever. So the city of God is Jerusalem. And finishing this chapter, the city does come up, but it's not like it's huge. Its presence is that huge in the, but the city itself is huge in Scripture. In terms of our eschatological hope, it's in the city where we're going. All right. So what I'm trying to say is that we can just touch on it a little bit. And I thought, I'm not really dealing with the city in any detail at all. This would be a PhD subject to somebody to delve into the city of God and do a study on that. So I'm just going to hit the top of it. And I know that there are some issues that in my mind have been raised that are not satisfactorily answered either. But for brevity, we have just a few minutes here to talk about it. We'll just kind of hit the top. And maybe someday in another life, we'll talk about it further. Maybe when we're sitting in the New Jerusalem, we can explain to Don how it really is. We talk about Mike's book. We'll go into that. Comprehensive restoration, what he advocates. And we have this in our history already. The restoration of all things will depend on the Son, not on their kings. So just to get the context for chapter 54, all we like sheep, 53. In the section last week, identifies a messianic suffering servant. It may be the high watermark in the clarity of Scripture on this issue. Not only are the Jewish promises of restoration tied up in this person, but so is the redemption of the rest of humanity even the restoration of his habitat. Mike's book. Point of Mike's book. Beginning with his suffering, ending in his voluntary death as a servant. I had to put in there a voluntary death of the servant because the servant was not killed on the cross. Right? He gave it up voluntarily. It looked like he died. He died on the cross, but the cross did not kill him. Just a small point. I had to put that in there because somebody raised your question. So we have with this Isaiah 53, we have a one-of-a-kind marker event in the person and death of Christ. The message, the plan of God has now been exploded in 53 in the great details of his life and death. It's not only just his death, but his life also evidences who he is. Doesn't pay for anything with his life. That is called act of obedience theology. God, Christ is not actively obeying the law for us so that we don't have to keep it. That is bogus. The message, the plan of the Lord has now been exploded in great detail in his life and death. The plan has been exploded. The prophet asked in Isaiah 53, who has believed our message or who has believed our report? And it is clear that some have indeed understood or accepted it, that God will intervene and save his people and the nation. That's the report. That's the message, that God will someday intervene and save the nation, the people and the nation. The prophet tells them that those that believe, have understood, their bleak future, which for them is yet thousands of years long, has turned into a great hope with great prosperity. Well, and it's a prosperity as in children or in sons. And I do not think I have been able to express the loss that has happened in our culture in the loss of the class of the reproductive aspect of our species, the mothers. You know, it's just like, well, you know, and it started slowly. You know, they're just like all of us. They do the same thing. No, I'm talking about us men. We're all alike. We're all alike. The message, well, they're all alike. We're all alike. We're all alike. We're to the point where they're so much alike that they're going to deny even the physical realities of being different. They could have done that without the foundation that was laid for decades. So the prosperity of children or sons is something that our culture has totally abandoned, but it is not abandoned in Scripture or in the life of Israel, which we'll see. So how it is for us? Well, our children are being slaughtered in the womb. Fewer and fewer people become parents. Is that an attack on children? It was not so in Israel. At the time, all people understood the value of children. And for most of us that sit here a little older, and most of us probably have children, understand that. I mean, I don't know what we would do without our kids. I mean, they feed us and they haul us around and all that kind of stuff. So now we're in a situation now where the phenomena of our time is to kill with honor, by the way, with honor, with distinction, and with praise and adoration, the termination of the next generation. You're doing a wonderful thing for humanity by killing it. Now, get that figured out yet? I don't have that figured out. And it's sold on the basis of some kind of idea that there's freedom involved in this. Well, in former times, children were a measure of God's blessing on the family and by extension, the nation, of course. And that is something that nations still do. Some do. Some nations realize that they're losing their population because the reproduction quotient is declining to the point where they can't replace themselves. And I think it's below 1.8. It cannot recover. So some countries know that. And the olden days, everybody knew it. For if not one thing, every born person into the nation is a taxpayer. They're killing off your taxpayers. If they didn't understand anything else, they should have understood that. So in former times, the children were a measure of God's blessing on the family and by extension of nations. Children came to be at great cost. They came at great cost in the mortality of mothers. And that is not very many years ago with penicillin. That was during the World War, Civil War. And after that, you finally figured out what infection is. So these easy ends, these easy terminations of pregnancies renders the child worthless. I mean, they're just throw it away. Just throw it away. It's so easy. It's just throw it away. There's no cost to anybody now. It was not long ago that half the children did not achieve adulthood. That would be in my grandparents' days. So now all of a sudden, children are worth it. I'm setting this up because the children are going to be the heritage of Israel. We don't understand that. I'm saying we need to understand that. This is from a newspaper. Well, I thought it was interesting. It is our generation that has been lied to. Duh. Now, it talks about climate change here. The climate change myth is just that. It's a myth. It does, and this is something very interesting. It does the very thing it purports to prevent. We're going to save the planet. No, climate change is going to destroy the planet. Same thing with children. Killing the children will save our planet. Duh, how's that going to work? The climate change myth is just that. It does the very thing it purports to prevent and replaces the creator with the creator. This is in a newspaper, in bold newsprint. And these created people now are the global elites. And the planet is designed for humanity. My point, don't have to come to my class to know that. You know that just from intuition. In fact, one could say the Earth is remarkably unique and specifically made for human beings to live and thrive and live forever on the Earth. The biblical edict to be fruitful and multiply seems to be a lot wiser and healthier and more enjoyable than lithium mining, electric, and eating bugs, which is so interesting, pushing eating bugs now instead of beef. I said, don't you understand? Bugs are living beings too. They just happen to be small. And you can't look into their faces and see how they cry when you kill them. Like when you look in the face of a white-faced, whatever, and you kill them. Oh, the poor thing. Well, the bug's got the same kind of human. Or, yeah, whatever. Got it. I came to hear that, right. Well, this, for the Jews, they probably are all kind of more or less the same color family, so I've excused that and look for a better one. Now the prophet describes their prosperity, this is the prosperity of the Jews, future in terms of their children. Starts out with the chapter, shout for joy, O barren one, you have borne no child. Break forth into joyful shouting and cry aloud, for you have not travailed. That means what I think we have here, we don't have a single woman here. We have a married woman who, for some break of things, has not had children. So now there's announcement that this barren one's going to have children. Now, all this time, she's been looking over the fence and seeing her neighbor over here. She's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 children. She still sits with no children. She's got a husband. I mean, things are there that could happen. She could have children. It's just not happening. So all of a sudden, we send the sons of the desolate will be the one, the sons of the desolate, like this woman. The desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman. So all of a sudden, this woman who first didn't have any children would have more children than the woman across the fence had. That's the point. So the barren one, married woman, is childless compared to the married woman. Now the was married unchild without children is going to now supersede the other one. The point is children. In fact, to the point, you got to build a bigger house, buy more land. You got so many children, you'd have room for them all. Stretch the place of your tent, stretch out the curtains of your dwelling, spare not. I mean, don't, this is too much. No, open it up more and more and more. You're going to need more and more space. Lengthen the cords of your tents here and strengthen your pegs, for you will be spread abroad to the right and to the left. I mentioned that's to the east and to the left, east and to the west. And the descendants will possess nations and will resettle the desolate city. So we have a mass influx of humanity here through the prosperity of Israel. Instead of being killed, they're being prosperous. So the land here is shown, the kingdom will be larger than anything ever achieved before. So now this whole gets down back to the woman who doesn't have children, her shame and her widowhood, not having children. That's part of the same picture here. Fear not, for you will not be put to shame, and do not feel humiliated. You will not be disgraced without children, but you will forget the shame of your youth. Again, not children, and the reproach of your widowhood. You will remember no more, for your husband now, your maker is your maker, whose name is the Lord of hosts, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of all the earth. So in other words, metaphorically, your husband is the God the Father. So he's going to produce these children for you. We're talking about Israel. Talk about Israel. Well, how it was? Well, for the Lord has called you like a wife, forsaken and grieved in spirit. Okay, for the Lord has called you like a wife, forsaken and grieved in spirit. Even like a wife of one's youth, she was rejected. So we have this barren woman now, can't even get close to her husband before. But now, for a brief moment, it says, I forsook you, like the husband will forsake relationship with his wife. For a brief moment, I forsook you, but with great compassion, I gather you. Take you back in. In an outburst of anger, I hid my face from you for a moment. Okay, he admits that. But with everlasting kindness, no doubt hesed here, I will have compassion on you, the woman that was barren, now going to have all these children. So, change the scene here now. We go to a flood, not a metaphor, a flood, a historical picture here. The flood judgment of past. For this is like the days of Noah. What's like? Well, the judgment that's coming. So this fiery judgment for a moment is like the day of Noah to me, when I swore that the waters of Noah would not flood the earth again. So I have sworn that I will not be angry with you. Again, now we're looking forward to a judgment, but when that judgment's over, then it's over. So the last judgment is the tribulation. After that point, nor will I rebuke you. So this is a prophylactic look again to the future. It's as if something's already happened, really hasn't happened yet. So as in my judgment, the tribulation, I add now the text, for the mountains may be removed, and they will be, and the hills may shake, and they will, but my loving kindness will not be removed from you, and my covenant, I think here's the new covenant of peace, will not be shaken, says the Lord, who has compassion on you. So at this point, there is no more judgment. Okay, remember, we're in a section of Isaiah where it's the comfort ye section, and we're looking forward to glorious joy, but all the things that God promised for Israel will come true. So now we're going to express joy in residing in the city of Jerusalem, and the city is so important. We're all identified with the city of Jerusalem. For the Lord has, by the way, there's a lot of passages we can look this up, and I had a book that listed a bunch of them, so it took a lot of time. So I took a couple of reps, just two, out of there and shown you what the Bible says about Zion or Jerusalem that's not in Isaiah. For the Lord has chosen Zion. Well, that's Zion, it's Jerusalem. He has desired it for his habitation. What did I say here? City of God. He's going to live in this place. This is my resting place forever. Got it? This is my resting place in heaven forever. It's not in some beautiful isle somewhere. This is the place where he's going to rest forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. Now, that was Psalm 120, 132, 13, 14. Now, Zechariah 2, 12, and 13. The Lord will possess Judah and his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. You know, he rejected for a while, like the husband did his wife, and then he chose her back again. So now he chose Jerusalem again. So be silent, all flesh, before the Lord, and for he is roused from his holy habitation that goes forth first, of course, in judgment, then in peace. So this is, a lady writes this from a book, what she writes, what on earth is heaven like? And the points are a lot what I have taught. And I don't agree with everything she says here, so I'm going to point that out, which is what you have to do. After running through many verses, she does this. Thus, multiple prophets all point to the same location. Massive, topographical changes will occur just prior to this city's descent. That's what I've been saying. Both Ezekiel and John give details about the future Jerusalem that correlate point by point, which is what I've said. These prophecies certainly seem to be talking about the same city, Ezekiel in Revelation, the city that the heroes of the faith were looking forward to, Hebrews 11:10, who the city whose architect and builder is God. Now, I think she's wrong here about who's, I think no one's occupying that city, but she says it exists now in the spirits of those heroes dwell there. I don't think anybody dwells there until after the Bema seat, because the Bema seat's where you get assigned your reward, and your reward has to be part of where you live in the city. That's my idea of it. And he said, Paul tells us this Jerusalem is now up above in heaven. I don't agree with that statement either. But the point of the rest of it is really important, is okay. Okay, so Jerusalem will come down from God out of heaven. Someday the new Jerusalem on earth will be the source of blessing, not only to God's people who live in it, but also all the people of the world. I'm trying to show that there. And you know this diagram I have used before. And I think this all happens here at the second advent. The new Jerusalem comes down. It comes down for the kingdom, and the major changes are occurring there. And the Bible talks about this time as the time of the regeneration, restoration, and refreshing. It's set free from corruption and made all things new. Why in the world do you bifurcate all those promises and put some of them in the beginning of the millennium and some of it at the end of 1,000 years? I don't know, because they all seem to fit at the beginning of it after all. But Mike talks about preconceived ideas, and we have to get rid of some of those. And I think that we have to get rid of some of those old ideas, because it works a whole lot better this way. So what is the city? So for all Israel, no matter where you live, what is the city? For all of Israel, no matter where you live in the world, Jerusalem is the home and the emblem and embodiment of the hope of Israel. On our trip into Israel in 2008, we ended it by coming into Jerusalem from Jericho on Highway 1. This is a 4,000-foot slow grinding ascent from the Jordan River Valley. Now, that's 100 feet per mile. You say, well, that's not much. Well, right now, if you go to Colorado, its average ascent is 6 foot a mile. So you're going to go uphill, and you're on a bus. It's going to grind in one of the lower gears. Now, they got big, powerful buses. Now, they just drive them up. But this is a steep hill. Okay, so our Jewish guide was on that bus. He was a native, Jewish native of the land and of the city. And we approached the city. The Tower of Mount Scopus cannot be seen on this picture, but that's where it is. And it makes a circuitous route to the right and then back to the left over the mountain range in the back of the city of Jerusalem. Now, a little closer, the final approach to the city was about 10 minutes as we made the ascent. Yossi, our guide, took on the persona of a child. I still remember this. Pacing the aisle of the bus, expressing his joy coming home. It was as if he had been gone 10 years. Larry and Sharon, you were there. You remember that?
Yes.
Okay. And maybe somebody else was. I'm watching Yossi. I don't care about the... But look at him. He is excited about Jerusalem. He's been gone for 10 years. No, he's only been gone for a week. But see, that's his love for his city. And it was genuine. It wasn't put on for a show, I don't think. See, it was not that he had been gone 10 years, now returning. The truth was he was only gone for less than a week. Well, when we were about 10 minutes out before the crossing into the from the West Bank into Jerusalem, he started to play the great late 19th century song sung by John Starnes, Jerusalem and Pete. I did find out Jerome Hines, and I played it. And I was going to bring it to you, and for your honor, I was going to play it, but we don't have time.
That's the only one to listen to.
Yeah, if you want after class, I'll play it for you, so you can come, you can stop by. I have the other one, too. Okay, so the song, John Starnes sings this song, need a tenor singer. As we made our way, I was more enraptured by Josie's excitement to see the city than I was watching for the city itself. All this to understand, Jerusalem has a supernatural place in the hearts of the Jews. It's placed there by God, even an unbeliever. All this is comparable to the following focus on Jerusalem, the city of our God. So here's how it goes about the city, switching to the personified city. O afflicted one, Jerusalem. Storm-tossed Jerusalem. Not confronted, comforted Jerusalem. Behold, here's the switch. Behold, I will set your stones in antimony, which is just a black stone setting, like the mud sets a stone in. So it's something, stone set on something black, it would show it. And your foundations I will lay in sapphires. Anybody have a sapphire here this morning? No, I have one. See, not everybody has one of those. Think about that. So they're kind of rare, at least in our life. Moreover, I will make your battlements of rubies. Anybody have rubies here this morning? Got one over there. How about that? And your gates of crystal. Now, does anybody have any crystal at home? I don't mean glass. I mean crystal. Anybody have crystal at home? Yeah, got a little more of that? None over here? It's rare stuff. It's expensive stuff. Beautiful stuff, right? And your entire wall of precious stones. Now, I suppose I could say, anybody have precious stones? You'd probably all raise your hand. But you don't have a lot of them, do you? And you kind of keep it in a certain place. You might even keep it in your safe at home or in the jewel box. So we have here described the city in terms that we probably can understand as being a city that has glory attached to it. It's beautiful. I mean, I don't frankly think that a stone city made of rubies would be all that pretty. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of odd. But if you're going to express it somehow, that's how you do it. You know, if the whole wall is made of a ruby, that'd be one thing. And the whole gate is made of crystal, that'd be another thing. So, I think that we have something that's kind of run over quickly by a poet, setting up the idea that this city now is a wonderful city. It's been afflicted. It's been storm-tossed. It's been not confronted. Now it's got all these good things going with it, going for it. So the city is dressed up to approximate the glory of God. That's approximate. That's all it can do in the grace given to its inhabitants. The stones are beautiful, if not precious. Scarcity in the kingdom is a foreign idea. So we have in it the best earthly term. We have it in the best earthly terms a city's beauty can be described. If you want to do better, go ahead. I don't know what you'd say. Well, so far so good. But which city is this? Now, I'm going to say here, I cannot be dogmatic like I started my lesson. This is a really big question here and how this all works out. So I cannot be dogmatic. We can answer this by comparing the description of the New Jerusalem, the city that comes down from heaven, described in Revelation 21. The description has the same spirit of glory, but it is constructed differently with precious stones, apparently. I'm just saying apparently. Because in Isaiah 54, we have this, and in Revelation 21, we have this. So the foundations are sapphire. Revelation says 12 different stones. The battlements in Isaiah 54 is rubies. Doesn't say anything about them in Revelation 21. The gates in Isaiah 54 are crystal, but they're pearls in Revelation 21. The walls are precious stones, and then we have 21, jasper and gold. Nothing said about the streets, but in Revelation 21, we have gold. So the one that's starkly different is the gates. You know, they're pretty obvious what a gate is, and if it's different, then you think, well, there's something different here. Because one is made of crystal and the other one made of pearl. That isn't really alike. Unless you say, well, the hinges are made of crystal, but the gate that swings is made of pearl. I mean, you can do that kind of stuff, but I don't know that we need to do that. So we have a possibility here that we're actually maybe showing two different cities. How many do I see there? I'm trying to show you two cities. I'm trying to show you one. I'm not totally sold on this. Don't get me wrong. This is one city, and then this is another city. This is the earthly city, and that's the heavenly city. But they've joined together. So the description is similar, but not as the city described in Revelation 21. The gate feature is different. It is the old Jerusalem made new. The old Jerusalem made new. The original made precious compared to the heavenly Jerusalem, new heavenly Jerusalem, which was introduced in John by John chapter 14, detailed in Revelation 21. So how do we account for these two renditions of Jerusalem? Well, it should be clear that Jerusalem, the city of peace, is in the center of God's plan. Got that over here. I believe history started here. I do happen to believe that here's the Garden of Eden was here. There's more evidence for Garden of Eden here than down in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. I believe history started here with the rebellion in the garden. Sinful history will end here in the establishment of the kingdom. Is that how God generally does things in some kind of poetic, justice? The Jews understood a bodily resurrection to this place. It was the resurrection was to a life lived, not to an unknown place. Because Job says, from my flesh I will see God. That was understood. I'm not going somewhere else in the resurrection. I'm going to stay right here. Now, the church has promised what was not revealed in the Old Testament. That's true. Quickly, there's nothing done to the Jewish expectation or national promises by the introduction of the church. The idea, Jewish idea of the kingdom of heaven on earth never changes. the new heavenly city was introduced by John in chapter 14 in Jewish ears, and those guys all died, and they will be in that new city. Nothing tricky here. He says, I'll go to prepare a place for you. Though the resurrected Jews will occupy this city as well. So number one, the first New Jerusalem, the New Jerusalem of John comes down to earth. It is identified with the earth, And no longer is it the heavenly Jerusalem, it's now Jerusalem on earth, and it houses features necessary to carry out the plan of God, Isaiah 67 and 21, Revelation, the same. He will dwell amongst people, which includes the earthbound population, of course, the redeemed of the New Jerusalem in glorified bodies. So everybody fits into this idea. Number two, the New Jerusalem, the original city of which we visited, the city of peace, gets a makeover. You ladies know what that means. This is what is described in Isaiah 54, I think. It is also the throne of God, the location of God, and it is made of precious stones. We saw that in precious stone materials. The confusing part is that we have two New Jerusalems, one from heaven and one from earth. But then how else would you say it? It appears that these two cities will be melded into one identity with compartments, appropriate for the earth-dwelling saints and the glorified bodied resurrected saints of the dead and the raptured. So they all live there. Now somebody, Ann was sharp last week. She caught me in an error. And she called me on the carpet. And I appreciate that. I was not clear last week about what I said about the resurrection of the bodies, glorified bodies. So here it is. No one has a glorified body in heaven now. That's what I said. I made it sound like they already do. No, they don't have a glorified body in heaven. They're waiting for the resurrection, waiting for the rapture. So that waits for the rapture and the associated believers' resurrection. Glorified body, embodied saints will be in heaven then for a short time with their bodies, before they return to earth, where they will long to return to, because that's the place God created for them. I'm not suggesting they're unhappy or uncomfortable or wishing that God doesn't think. No, I don't mean that. It's just that, you know, like you long for something and let's go back to where you were. And with a glorified body, you have the tools in which to do that. And of course, God's going to go there first, so you'll follow him to earth. Okay, so perhaps we can approximate these two entities. This is not very good, but what else can I do? The city of Los Angeles has specific borders or limitations. However, out here in Nebraska, we see Los Angeles as one city, but the reality is that it is a central city with many more cities around it. Yet for us all, it is Los Angeles. And, you know, in my flatline days when I figured out how things work, trying to find a place to live on vacation in Kansas City, so I look for a place in Kansas City, and I can't find it. And I said, well, the reason you can't find it, it's not in Kansas City at all. It's in Olathe. Oh, Olathe is different than Kansas City, huh? But it's all Kansas City, isn't it? That's how I always thought it was. So try to find an accommodation in Kansas City with using a GPS, only find your hotel is actually in Olathe or Lee's Summit or wherever else. So that's what I'm saying. We see things in a general way, like we're saying, this is the New Jerusalem, but you look up closer, you find out there's some divisions and distinctions within the New Jerusalem. Some of it originated on earth, some of it came from heaven, from the heavenlies. Yet these two cities, they all talked about in the same place. So we may have difficulty in showing the exact relationship, but we do have statements in occupying the same proximity. That seems to be the problem. They all seem to say they're parked in the same place. Well, Ezekiel 42 talks about a description of a temple and a city complex. Ezekiel 40 and 48 describes the temple for kingdom purposes, but leaves the heavenly city and the earthly Jerusalem as simply a structure like a city, which he sees in Ezekiel 40, verse 2. So he doesn't dwell on it. We want more information, but it's there. It's there. So this is one way that, or many people have shown it this way. This is one way of showing the city in the large dimension on the temple city complex. I mean, it's a huge place on Israel. You see, it takes from Jerusalem clear up almost to Sea of Galilee to the Valley of Armageddon. And the box that you see white is actually the city marked in there. I think it's like 10 miles on a side. And I'd suggested that these two can occupy somewhat the same place. You have the Revelation city parked on top of it, maybe a layer, like a layer cake. I don't know. in the city of Isaiah below it. This shows a charismatic relationship. It's not to scale. Sometimes I show it to you like this last week, the New Jerusalem sitting on the ground like that. Then you don't have the old Jerusalem demarc. You don't have a fence for it, which I think our passage talks about a different kind of gate. So it makes me think there's another layering around this. My idea. Not sure. And then we had the real problem with this whole thing of the city is the size of it. Well, Janice Willis suggests a 1,500 mile, which is miles, rather than being the end size is the root of 11.5 cubed, which would give you that number. Whatever the solution, in other words, it gets reduced a lot when she does that. And she has some Greek ideas about this, and I'm not going to pass judgment on her. All I'm going to show you that there are different ways of looking at this that when it gets down to it, folks, the size of it shouldn't be a problem, no matter what size of it is. If it said it was the size of a thimble, it would be okay with me. But it doesn't say that. It says something else. And the size that she suggests would fit more like what the Bible describes in Ezekiel, the size of the New Jerusalem on earth. So maybe she's got a point there. Because she goes into some kind of group idea. If there's three numbers, so like three numbers are like a cube, then multiply each other, then you get that big number. So you go the other way, you get down to a smaller box, which fits somewhat this picture that we have here of New Jerusalem. Now, that may be like somebody looking for an answer in the problem, but not being able to get to the answer by doing the problem. I understand that. So I told you, I don't know what this means exactly, so you can do your own study. Maybe someday I will do this, but I really don't have a lot of interest in it because you know what? I think God can figure this out. And if I do get it figured out, I'll still have to say, I'm not sure how this works. Okay. So the literal 1,500-mile look, I've had this problem more than any other question about it. If you're inflexible on the size, you say it's got to be 1,500 miles. It can't be anything less. Okay, fine. We can accept this. It may be unseen in another, so I would say it may be unseen in another dimension. That's a possibility. When Jesus left, at some point he disappeared and he walked through walls, which didn't seem to be possible. So we got a new body here, and the habitat we live in probably would be what we call a transparent spot. Because after all, most of what we have in our life is space. You know, there is something like an atom is the difference, the size of the space in the atom is like, if you're standing here at the nucleus, the first electron would be somewhere in northern Kansas, and that much space there is in the atom. And so you can see there could be lots of coexisting beings in the same space. That's not a very scientific approach, but there's a lot of space in what we consider solid material. So it may be unseen in another dimension, therefore it loses its grotesque appearance, which is what you always say. Well, that looks terrible. How can you have something so big wobbling around the world like that? That can't be right. Well, I can live with any solution that you come up with. I can live with any solution except that you cannot deny its existence. That I can't buy. So the size of the city is a common stumbling block in how it attaches to the earth. Size. Well, whatever the size, small or large, our minds will not process what's being revealed anyway. If it could be a thimble, we won't understand it. If we make it big, we won't understand it because we don't understand how it works. So how can we judge it? So we just go with what it says and wait to see. So for all the struggles we have with shoehorning the cities into place, we will at some point abandon the effort, won't we? We are told that the Lord's ways are not our ways. When it comes to the internal spaces, we are better saying, I don't understand than abandoning the text for what it says. That's why the pressure is, I can't understand, therefore I got to abandon it. No, that's not the option. I can say, I don't understand, and that's the end of it. Don't say, then I have to abandon it because I don't understand it. Now, we have a few verses here. And it still talks about this joy of being restored. All your sons will be taught of the Lord, and well-being, your sons will be great. In righteousness, you will be established. You will be far from oppression, for you will not fear from terror, for it will not come near you. Now, these verses, remember, I told you this before, when you have these comparisons, you will not need to fear. You're not to worry about oppression. That doesn't mean that there's going to be oppression in the kingdom. This is a comparison with how it is now and how it's going to be then. So they don't have to worry about oppression then because it won't exist. But today we have to worry about oppression. Same way goes with the rest of them. if anyone stirs up strife, as example, it is not from me. God's not going to cause trouble. Well, will there be other people that are going to cause strife in the kingdom for these people? No, God wouldn't allow it. So whoever stirs up strife with you shall fall because of you. God is at peace. God is at peace. Therefore, do not fear. My parenthetical. So it is I who created the smith who blows the fire of the coals and produced weapons fit for his purpose. I have also created the ravager to destroy. So in other words, God admits that in the past he's done it, but not now. So again, comparison is not the threats in the kingdom, but compared to Isaiah's day. Therefore, we now say, no weapon that is fashioned, and it won't be, there can't be any, against you will prosper, and you shall refute every tongue that rises against you in judgment. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and the vindication from me, says the Lord. And remember, this is a comparison of how it was in Isaiah's day to the way it's going to be in the kingdom. So the future for Israel cannot be any brighter. That is, after they pass through the judgment like the flood, this is going to be the judgment of fire, tribulation, only this time will be by fire. So the opportunities are gone. The repentance opportunities are still here with the living. Then we have the next chapter. Verse 1 says, ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You have no money. Come, buy, eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. And that's the invitation to get with the program. And that's the invitation. Not only does Isaiah start to wind this up in, but also how Revelation ends up in chapter 22, I think it is. Okay. Quick comment. We're past time, but I will take a comment. Yes, Mike. You're always there to help. Thank you. That's what I say. That happens at the second advent. It has to, because the things that happened before don't happen anymore. And they're the thermodynamic issues. They're due to physics, energy. So that's why, to me, the best thing is to put all that up front there and then let the kingdom enjoy those benefits rather than say, well, now we got some benefits that are down at the end of it yet. So why? And another thing I got to mention here, don't want to get into all these off subjects, but the real hang-up is always sin in the kingdom. Sinning in the kingdom. That's why it's got to be changed at the end. The Bible never addresses it, except it says God will rule with an iron hand. It won't happen. So, well, we make a big deal, but God doesn't. In fact, I thought this week, if it wasn't for the end of the first 1,000 years where the fire comes out and destroys the rebels, if that statement wasn't in the Bible, we would have no idea that there were any unrighteous in the kingdom. Think about that. That's the only way we know there were. Because the unrighteous in the kingdom don't shape the culture. Death's been done away with the coming of Christ. Okay, so we'll stop there. We go into Isaiah 55 next week, and like the little